This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Hello, this is Joel Hilliker, managing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine. It's time once again to discuss this past week's important news with our panel. Here in the studio, we have Jeremiah Jacques.
Great to be with you.
And Andrew Miller.
Hello.
From our office in Britain, we have Richard Palmer.
Good afternoon.
And Brent Noctegal, also in Britain. Hello.
Hello.
We're going to start today with two stories about events there. First, Sudan, then Libya. In Sudan, where the brutal man who's been president for 30 years was ousted, we're going to learn what is next for this country by turning to Brent.
What's going to happen next in Sudan? We're not too sure after the leader was removed from power by the army after 3 decades in power. President Omar al-Bashir was a brutal dictator. He had at his hands, there was about 300,000 people that have been killed back in Darfur in the early 2000s, a number of other pretty horrific events he has been behind. He's a wanted war criminal, of course, at The Hague also. Although the man that's in power right now, led by the army, says that they're not going to extradite the president. He's going to stay there. So they're not going to give him over to anybody. The interesting thing about this, as we're looking at it, as another leader in Africa has fallen because of popular protest, popular demonstrations have been taking to the streets for months now. They finally got so strong that the army saw fit to depose this leader. And so while there might be rejoicing everywhere over the planet right now that this man is finally gone, we don't really see any concrete change coming out or the people that have taken over. There is going to be a 2-year process in which the army is going to rule, and then hopefully there'll be elections and things like that. But it's too early to tell whether Sudan is going to change the style of leadership that this man directed. Now, the protests themselves, they have continued kind of like what we saw, what we've been seeing in Algeria. The long-term strongman steps down, and yet the people are not satisfied because they see the military taking control. Democracy has not run its course here in Sudan. And so the protests are going to continue. There was a 10 p.m. curfew that was imposed on everybody last night. People came out and broke the curfew to continue protesting. And so while they see it as a small victory, the unrest hasn't ended in Sudan.
Brent, can you just remind us of the prophetic overview of what we're looking for in Sudan and maybe even the region more broadly?
Right. So if we're talking about this this western part of the Red Sea passageway, you have Ethiopia and Eritrea to the south, then Sudan, then Egypt. Bible prophecy is very clear that this whole corridor of land is going to be in alliance with Iran and radical Islam. And so we watch for unrest in Egypt or in Sudan or potentially in Eritrea and Ethiopia as being something that Iran would like to capitalize on and try and controlling this vital Red Sea passageway. In Sudan's case, they have in the past decades been a very big opportunistic country seeking alliances whichever favored them. Iran has been a key alliance of Bashir for a number of years. They fell out back in 2016 because basically the Saudis bought influence inside Sudan and Bashir said, fine, I'll go with the Saudis. But before then, Iran regularly docked at a port there, sent weapons up to Hamas through Sudan. Israeli warplanes have come down on jets, have struck at factories inside Sudan because of the connection to the IRGC and Iran. And so that type of the situation right now, when you have a population that is not happy with the leadership, especially the military rule, and generally the military, I would say, isn't going to be so favorable towards Iran. But Iran is so well and so good and so adept at using these situations of destabilized nations to infiltrate, to try and work with certain parties, bribe certain parties as much as possible, find Islamist parties that are willing to accept Iranian patronage, even trying to set up Shia different Shia schools and things like that to try and really use this moment to try and cement the country for them. Iran thinks really long term, and so when they see a former ally inside as this president leaving office, they are going to look for a way in there. And Bible prophecy says some way or another they will be able to do that.
So they have had this relationship with this individual, and the fact that he's leaving just because, as you said, this isn't because of a democratic uprising. This is essentially his own people saying we are going to take him out of the way because he's become too much of a liability. We would expect that there wouldn't necessarily be a massive political realignment taking place here, but we can keep our eyes on what are Iran's next moves, given the instability in his absence.
Exactly. Iran is going to try and make a play in the situation. That is their goal. And in terms of popular uprisings in the Middle East, everybody knows that Islamists make the most of them. As in, when the Islamic Spring happened, there was only one nation, Tunisia, that was a success story. All the other nations that lost the dictator, they resorted to, it was more Islamist style. Well, Islamists made the most of it. And so when we have this happening in northeast Africa, we expect that same type of thing to take place.
So you mentioned this Red Sea strategy of Iran. Maybe you could just direct our listeners to where they could get more information about that, why that's so prophetically significant.
Yeah, people can read our editor-in-chief's booklet on Libya and Ethiopia in prophecy. I think that's great. Those are the kind of the two bookends of this swath of territory: Libya in the north, in the central north there of Africa, and Ethiopia towards the central part of Africa. That coastline, including Egypt and including Sudan, is all going to belong to this Iranian king of the south. And from those territories, they're going to use to make a push and a play at Europe. That's what the Bible says in Daniel chapter 11, verse 40 to verse 45.
All right. Well, thank you, Brent. And we'll just move right up north of there in North Africa to Libya, and to bring us up to speed with what's happening there, and particularly how Europe is responding to it, we'll go to Richard Palmer.
Yes, fighting has continued in Libya as General Haftar and the Libyan National Army continue to fight other Libyan forces outside Tripoli. It seems that he was hoping for a quick victory, and the fighting still going on a week on. It looks like that's probably not going to happen. And this is something that's of huge concern to Europe. Like we talked about on Wednesday's show, not just because of Libya, but because of just all the other unrest that we heard about from Brent in North Africa. Just even since we spoke on Wednesday, there have been unrests in Morocco and Mauritania now as well. So you're seeing some spread across all of North Africa. And European leaders are worried. One estimate said that there could be around 600,000 migrants ready that they've already left their homes.
Wow.
They're already on their way to Europe. They're stuck in Libya, and that this extra fighting could prompt them to come over to Europe now. And then you could have even more, hundreds of thousands of more, potentially millions more, coming in from Libya, coming directly to Europe. So this is of huge concern to Europe. And European leaders got together. They wanted to make a statement, at least, about what's happening in Libya to try and gain some control of the situation, and they failed utterly. They wanted to speak with a united voice and condemn what General Haftar was doing, to call on him to withdraw his forces, to stop his attack on Tripoli so that they could try and calm things down and not have a civil war there that could send wave after wave of migrants. But the trouble is, Europe has to have unanimity when it comes to foreign policy, which is even harder to achieve than it is to say. All 28 nations, like still 28, sadly this isn't Brexit day for the UK, but all 28 nations have to agree. Mm-hmm. And France said no. They kind of have their own relationship with Haftar. It looks like they've given him some support, potentially even military support in the past. So they said we're not going to back this. And so the best that Europe could come up with was basically a personal statement on behalf of Federica Mogherini, the EU foreign relations chief, but with no she was just almost just speaking on her own behalf, basically. So, I mean, speaking with a united front isn't even doing that much, but Europe failed to do exactly that, which, you know, is interesting when you think about how many of these different prophecies that ties into. Like Brent right. said, there are these scriptures in Daniel 11 that says that Libya is going to end up allied with Iran, end up allied with radical Islam. And you'd have thought that Europe would really be keen to do something to stop that happening. And you can see just that right now they're too divided to even make a statement about what is happening. We spoke on Wednesday's show about how potentially Haftar could be spreading himself too thin. Even since then, there have been some attacks from the Islamic State where they've taken the opportunity to launch some attacks of their own. And so you can see that. There's also these prophecies about Europe gaining a strong leader. And you can see how there's just so many of these events. Libya is just the latest one that just exposes how ridiculous Europe's situation is right now,
yeah.
with this 28 nations having to agree everything all together before they do it. You know, it shows that the situation doesn't work, and you can see that boosting their appetite for having a single leader.
In Daniel 2, when it describes this empire in prophecy, the 10 toes of that image that is described in Daniel 2 are composed of iron and clay, and it seems the fractious nature of the European project is always going to be there. But this certainly shows how untenable the political and military composition of Europe, as it is currently composed, is untenable. It can't last. There's got to be someone to step up to this a situation where they just are unable to act because of just how much disagreement there is among the leaders. It's definitely, as you said, there's so many of these prophecies that you see in play that something is going to have to change dramatically here.
And European leaders already see that. You know, this has been right. something that's gained a fair bit of discussion in France and Germany, where they've said we need to. I mean, this has been a platform of especially the center right in Germany, getting rid of the unanimity in European foreign policy decisions, at least making it so that the majority can have their way rather than everybody agreeing. But that's a big ask. You know, it's hard to get people to give up their own autonomy when it comes to some of these foreign policy decisions. And you could see how an absolute catastrophe like Libya going over to radical Islam, falling down like Syria has, that could add some serious urgency to Europe just getting its act together generally, coming together under a single leader, acting much more muscularly when it comes to the Middle East and North Africa. We've talked about they're already preparing, they've already taken steps to build up bases and things like that, but Libya disintegrating would really force them to step things up a notch.
Where would you send listeners who want more information, Richard?
Well, I just reiterate what Brent said. That booklet, Libya and Ethiopia in Prophecy, is a great place to start, because it goes through Daniel 11, and there's just so much detail that you can mine out of Daniel 11, the way it talks about that you've got the strategy that Iran is pursuing, where they're going after these countries. They're actively trying to gain a basis in the Red Sea. They're trying to gain a basis in the Mediterranean. We can see them doing that in Syria. You can certainly see them trying to apply the same strategy to Libya as that disintegrates into civil war. And then it talks about the way that Europe is responding to that and trying to prepare to surround Iran. So that booklet really helps bring those prophecies in Daniel 11 and just show how all of those details are happening in the headlines that you see every day.
You need to read that booklet. Today's show is brought to you by Libya and Ethiopia in Prophecy, and congratulations on pronouncing unanimity correctly the second time. It's very, very, very good. Thank you for that, Richard. You're listening to Trumpet Hour, our Week in Review program on 101.3 KPCG. We have Jeremiah Jacquebeck after a trip to Finland and Russia. He traveled through the Baltic Sea, where the Nord Stream 2 pipeline is being constructed, a project with very sensitive geopolitical consequences. To learn about this, here we are, Jeremiah.
Yeah, it's great to be back with you. Nord Stream 2 is now about 75% complete, and it will be finished later this year. We weren't really able to see much of the actual infrastructure of this. I mean, it's mostly underwater, sure. And they don't publish a lot of, you know, data of where exactly it is and things like that. But we were probably within a mile of it there in St. Petersburg. And this is a remarkable development for a number of reasons. It's an $11 billion project, and it's the longest set of subsea pipelines in the world. You know, it begins there in Leningrad Oblast in Russia, runs under the Baltic for almost 800 miles all the way to Greifswald there in northern Germany. And when the second set of these pipelines, Nord Stream 2, is completed later this year, it will double the current capacity, bringing it to almost 4 trillion cubic feet of gas per year that Russia can pump directly into Germany. So that puts Nord Stream close to the same level as Russia's Brotherhood pipeline that goes from Russia into Ukraine, which is the largest pipeline that Russia has and possibly the largest in the world in terms of capacity. So to have Nord Stream 2 just months away from coming online now and being able to pump almost that same quantity of gas directly into Germany, it really is just a remarkable geopolitical development.
So what is the significance and why would that give Russia so much power?
Yes, well, that's it. It is, the real significance is in the power that it gives to Russia and to Germany, and in the way that it binds them together. So for Russia, the pipeline really boosts its leverage over Ukraine and Belarus and other former Soviet nations. These are countries that Russia's been working to kind of bring back under its control as much as possible. And in the past, if Russia wanted to apply pressure on these countries by cutting off shipments of gas through those older pipelines, such as the Brotherhood pipeline that I mentioned there, those ones that go straight into it. Russia could do that. They could cut off those shipments. But those older pipelines were also Russia's main way of getting gas into Germany mm-hmm. and other parts of Western Europe. So that meant that if Russia was cutting off Ukraine or some other former Soviet nation, it was also cutting off the countries downstream, such as Germany. So with the completion of Nord Stream 2, Russia will be better positioned to shut off gas shipments to Ukraine or Belarus or some other country without affecting shipments to Germany. So if Russia decides to weaponize its gas mm-hmm. by, you know, forcing a country to freeze during a cold winter until it decides to submit to Moscow's will.
Which it's done.
Yes, several times in the past it's done exactly that, and now it'll have a much sharper blade, mm-hmm. a more precise blade on that, you know, that energy weapon, you could call it.
So you mentioned the way that this binds Russia and Germany together. Maybe you could talk about the significance of that.
Sure. Yes, these pipelines, I think they really should have more of the world's attention because of the way they bind Berlin and Moscow. They show that Russia and Germany today are closely cooperating in a way that undermines NATO and in a way that has very dark historic precedents. History is clear that in between times of war, Germany and Russia have often cooperated. And the most recent and probably the most troubling example of this was just before World War II when they signed the Molotov-Ribbentrop or the Hitler-Stalin Pact, mm-hmm. it's sometimes called. And that pact really helped to create the conditions for that worst war that humankind has ever suffered. Trumpet editor-in-chief Gerald Fleury wrote about this pact in the cover story for our September 2018 issue, and he explained how the Nord Stream pipelines today show that Russia and Germany are working out a modern Molotov-Ribbentrop pact. One quote from that says, "History shows that Germany and Russia are not actually partners. When they enter into peace deals and economic partnerships, it is a signal that either or both are preparing for some kind of imperialistic exploit. This makes Nord Stream 2 extremely concerning." Mm-hmm. End quote. So Mr. Fleury shows in his article that all of his analysis of this is built not just on history, but also on Bible prophecy. You know, there are Bible prophecies in the books of Ezekiel and Isaiah showing that there will be a period of really robust economic cooperation between a German-led bloc and a Russian-led bloc, and that will end up being to the detriment of the U.S. and Britain, and it'll actually even lead to a siege against the U.S. and Britain, and it'll you know, spiral into World War III. His article also points to the books of Jeremiah and Matthew, and he really shows how these trends underway with Nord Stream and associated developments, how they're leading to a prophesied time of unprecedented
conflict and suffering, but he also shows that beyond that conflict, there will be a time of unprecedented peace. So the article covers a lot. It goes into all that history, all the prophecy, and it just shows that there's a lot of hope really tied to this as well.
Germany and Russia's Secret War Against America is the title of that article by our editor-in-chief, and we will put a link to that article in the show notes for the program. You can also go on to thetrumpet.com, and on the front page there, we have a video and article by Jeremiah about this. The video is, he recorded it while he was over in that area, and so you can see the Baltic Sea there in the background, and it's good to know your trip was successful and good to have you back, and we appreciate that analysis as well, Jeremiah. Venezuela remains in conflict between two governments, and it's turning into something of an international battleground over the future of the country. As we've discussed, recent moves by Russia and the United States are pitting these two nations against each other. For this story, we'll turn to Andrew Miller.
Yeah, Venezuela, yeah, as you said, it's a huge battleground on the world scene right now, almost kind of like a proxy war or a proxy/Cold War between the world, with most nations now having taken aside, most Latin American nations and the United States, as well as several nations in Europe, have supported the opposition leader to step up as an interim president until free and fair elections can be held. And yet the normal group of anti-Western opposition in Russia, in Iran, in Turkey, in China have really cracked down supporting the regime of the current socialist president, Nicolas Maduro. In many ways, the nation's actually almost become like a Cuban colony, and that the Russians and the Chinese are using Cuba heavily to keep Maduro in power. The Cubans have sent probably anywhere between, the estimates range between 15 and 30,000 generals, military officers, spies, intelligence officers to prop up Maduro's regime. It's gotten to the point where there have been 7 military coup attempts against Maduro in the past year, but by his own military trying to overthrow him. So he doesn't even trust his own Venezuelan military officers anymore. Mm. So he's brought in communist military officers from Cuba to keep him in power. And the Cubans are very willing to do that because the Venezuelans send them something like 50,000 barrels of subsidized oil a day. It actually works out to be something close to 12% of Cuba's entire gross domestic product.
Wow.
Is Venezuelan oil. And so right now they're almost like one state, because neither regime can survive without the other. If Cuba didn't have Venezuelan oil, its economy would contract 12%. And if Venezuela didn't have Cuban military officers, Maduro would have probably already been ousted in a military coup.
So Maduro is essentially giving away the oil resources of his country at the expense of his people in order to preserve his own regime.
Right, yeah, he's giving away Venezuela's natural resources at cost, not making a dime of profit from it, in return for military officers to come in and oppress his people so they can't use that oil for themselves. So it's a bad deal for pretty much everyone involved.
Except for Nicolas Maduro.
Except for Nicolas Maduro and maybe the Castro, Raul Castro. I'm sure the Cuban people aren't thrilled living under his regime either. But that comes down to this proxy war. I think we covered on this last week or the week before that Russia's actually sent about 400 military contractors of its own to help those 20-something thousand Cuban intelligence officers keep Maduro in power, Russia also being heavily invested in the oil in the region. But President Trump has decided to fight back by hitting them where it hurts, and he's sanctioned, or had Vice President Mike Pence announce the sanctions on April 5th. The 34 boats owned by Venezuela's state oil company, they're the boats that take the oil to Cuba. And so right now, it's kind of hard to sanction a good that you're not buying yourself. They're basically sanctioning oil that goes from Venezuela to Cuba. But that opens the door that if the United States wants to get more strict with this, that they could use the power of the U.S. Navy to seize those boats and stop the oil from heading towards Cuba. Mm-hmm. President Trump kind of has a two-pronged strategy. One is shut down the oil exports to Cuba. And two, he's working with the president of Brazil, who's at least right now fairly pro-American. The Brazilians have close ties with the Venezuelan military. And so they have like some back channels they're able to use to convince more officers to defect against Maduro. So if the Brazilians can convince more military officers to defect and the U.S. Navy can stop the Venezuelan oil from ever reaching Cuba, they're hoping to enact regime change in at least Venezuela, maybe even Venezuela and Cuba, if you depending on how far you want to push that.
Mm-hmm. So Trump announced sanctions. How did Europe respond?
Europe's been ambivalent, I guess, in their official response. They have, unlike Russia, they're not openly supporting Maduro. They have backed the United States in calling for free and fair elections, but they've refused to join the sanctions. The Spanish especially are still buying plenty of Venezuelan oil. They've actually, it was a little earlier this year, they have officially, the European Union foreign policy chief, Federica Mogherini, officially condemned the United States embargo against Cuba. Haven't condemned the one against Venezuela yet, but the Europeans are definitely very interested in keeping Venezuelan oil flowing into Europe and in even increasing their economic investments in both Cuba and Venezuela, which is where this gets interesting prophetically, is that President Trump's plan, it's actually a fairly well thought out plan, this using Brazil to sow discord in the Venezuelan military and cutting off the oil exports to Venezuela or from Venezuela to Cuba.
Right.
But he's relying very much so on Brazil and at least hoping to rely more on Europe to put the pressure here. Venezuela is a Spanish-speaking country, predominantly Roman Catholic, part of, the, or at least it's suspended now, but was part of the Mercosur trade alliance in South America. So economically, religiously, linguistically, politically, it's very integrated with Latin America and Europe, more so than with the United States. And so when President Trump's trying to install a more pro-Western, anti-Russian government, but even if he's successful in doing that, it's going to be pro-Western government, and that it's pro-Catholic, pro-European, pro-Brazilian, more so than pro-American, which is something we've got an article, I've got an article online right now entitled President Trump's Venezuelan Strategy Will Backfire. And towards the end of it, it cites two chapters in the Bible, Revelation 17 and Isaiah 47, which the late Herbert W. Armstrong also cited those chapters, instructing and teaching that they're about like a great political religious power centered in Europe, but that uses religion around the world is kind of like the glue to bind together. Revelation 17 talks specifically about 10 nations in Europe. I think we mentioned them earlier in the program. The Roman Catholic religion being the glue that binds those 10 nations together, and also the glue that helps bring in other nations around the world in alliance with them, especially in South America. That's why Mr. Armstrong always predicted that the South American nations would almost be like vassal states to this emerging European empire. Our editor-in-chief, Gerald Fleury, has an entire chapter in the Isaiah's End Time Vision booklet, too, building towards a national, building towards a world catastrophe, that talks about these South American nations being like vassal states to the European Union and even used in an economic siege against the United States. And so based on these scriptures, this chapter explains that, like, these South American nations, Venezuela and Brazil, they're at some point in the near future, they're going to be cooperating with Europe against the United States economically, and in kind of a like a ironic fashion. It could actually even be President Trump's attempts to weaken Venezuela's alliance with Russia and China that actually increases the European aspect of that trade alliance in that region of the world.
Well, it's a fascinating situation to watch. Go check out Andrew's article online there. President Trump's Venezuelan strategy will backfire. There really are several prophecies that tie into this and the way that this is unfolding to create an opening for these foreign powers to have a strong presence there right in America's backyard. Definitely something to keep our eyes on. We'll also put a link in the show notes to Isaiah's End Time Vision, the booklet by Gerald Fleury. Thank you very much for that, Andrew. You're listening to Trumpet Hour. Coming up, Benjamin Netanyahu victorious in another Israeli election. We'll also have some news about China's alignment with Europe and friction with the Philippines. Also, America's marijuana use at a 14-year high. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Trumpet Hour, the Week in Review.
He did it again. No, not Donald Trump this time, but Benjamin Netanyahu. He won a historic fifth term as prime minister this week. For some analysis, we'll go back to Brent Noctegal.
Yes, Mr. Benjamin Netanyahu won the most. His Likud party won the most seats in the election. He won 36 seats. The closest rival, led by Benny Gantz, who's a former a general, first time in politics, he won 35 seats, his blue and white party. And there's 120 seats in the Knesset. So the leading vote getter got 36. You know that there's a lot of other parties involved. And so the way that Israel's system works, they are going to have to try and form a coalition government. And it's assumed that Mr. Netanyahu will receive that honor by the president, Reuven Rivlin, next week. And then he has a couple of weeks to show that he can form a majority in the 120-seat Knesset. So it does look like with Mr. Netanyahu combined with some other right-wing parties and the Orthodox parties that he will be able to get 65 seats. So he'll have a 5-seat majority. And what's interesting about this, of course, is that coming up to the election, again, the polls had the blue and white party getting more seats than Likud. It was still going to be very close given the coalition buildup to see who would have the majority. Again, here he is. I remember last time that the polls were wrong again, and he snatched the victory. And so what this says about Israel, of course, a number of things. It's just interesting looking at the policy of the blue and white party and Netanyahu's party. They are very similar. It's not like one's a leftist group and one's a rightist group. Yes, Mr. Netanyahu has more right-wing coalition partners, but some of the previous parts of his coalition that are further on the right, and they didn't actually make the threshold to come into the next Knesset, so they won't even be there, like Naftali Bennett and some others. And so Mr. Netanyahu basically gobbled up those votes that were further to the right than him and consolidated with his 35. And then the blue and white party gobbled up some of the leftist seats just because those leftists didn't like Mr. Netanyahu and they wanted somebody to replace him. But in terms of, I would say, policy, you have Israel as quite a united front right now in terms of security. The blue and white party is arguably more on the right wing than Netanyahu in terms of security. The Palestinian issue, both parties believe that there isn't a way forward in the peace process right now. Mm-hmm. And so while it might be played out in international press, because the press is governed by the left, even in Israel and around the world, that this is a step towards dictatorship or democracy dying in Israel. Mm. If you talk to an Israeli that's not writing for Haaretz, they would say democracy is alive and well. And yeah. So
is quite extraordinary to think here's a man who's been in office for a long time. You could say, well, voters are looking for some kind of a change. He has these corruption indictments that are hanging over him, a lot that is working against him. And you even had, I guess the sense that I have is Iran is trying to find a way to get him out of here, out of there, just pulling whatever levers it can to create instability on Israel's northern border and drone attacks and whatever else it can do. And, you know, rocket attacks on Tel Aviv. But it seems like the Israelis overall, they're happy with the way that he's kept them safe, and considering the rising threats against Israel, this is the man they want at the helm.
Right. Israel is the safest, it seems, right now that it's been in a number of years. While it sounds crazy, with Netanyahu at the helm, they believe that. Their alliances with other Middle Eastern states are at a place that they've never been in Israel's history. Israel economically is doing the best it's done in the past 30 years. And so there's a lot of reasons to vote for the sure thing. Now, Mr. Netanyahu, he worked for it. I mean, if you are following him on Twitter or something on social media, the days leading up to the election, he was everywhere in Israel, Jerusalem, going to the markets, posting video after video every hour, talking about the need for people to get out and vote for us quick. And he was impassioned. He's a man that's almost 70 years of age, and he was running around like a 35-year-old on election day. And compared to the opposition, I mean, it was quite amazing to watch. I mean, Mr. Netanyahu does, and the Israeli public, even though he has failings, of course, and even though some of them think he might have actually be guilty of breach of trust and these other things, they involve, you know, petty things. Having some favorable media coverage or accepting some gifts from some of his friends, some champagne and some cigars. It's not things that the Israeli public deem worthy enough to bring down a prime minister that's done them so much good for so long. Mm-hmm. And so they really want him to continue in power. Of course, the relationship with America is so strong right now. And a lot of that has to do with the constant lobbying of President Trump by Mr. Netanyahu and his sidekicks for the Golan Heights, for Jerusalem being moved. Yes, Mr. Trump has made those decisions, but that has been at the behest of this Israeli prime minister that believes, I don't know if he believes God's put him in that situation, but you listen to some of his early speeches and some of his interviews, and he definitely feels like he's fulfilling a providential role inside Israel right now, in strengthening that nation, especially the ties to the United States. And so he's not just a politician to stay in power. He's a sincere believer in Israel's future and that he is meant to safeguard that.
So now that the election has happened, we've talked about how the Trump administration has had this peace deal in the offing for quite some time, and they were waiting for after the election. Is that what we can expect next?
Yeah, that's definitely what we can expect next. Even the Jerusalem Post was writing about this, how that the victory that Mr. Trump is just – no, sorry, the victory that Mr. Netanyahu has just attained, it might be that feeling of victory is soured when we have Mr. Trump come through with his peace plan. This is what the Jerusalem Post said. Israel will soon learn the real cost of Santa Trump's stunning array of gifts recently bestowed upon the Jewish state, from allowing the so-called settlement enterprise to flourish, to sovereignty over Jerusalem and the Golan Heights, to moving the embassy, and possibly to annexing the West Bank. Lost in the euphoria of the gracious trove is its inevitable price tag. Surely the going rate will demand nothing less than obedience, cooperation, and acceptance of whatever terms are going to be revealed in the as-yet-unknown document. That's coming around the corner, and it's probably going to have Mr. Netanyahu be asked some difficult things of by Mr. Trump. And so while Israel might seem kind of united right now, that might threaten to disrupt that peace.
We will keep our eyes peeled for it, and thank you very much for that, Brent. You get an interesting perspective on the future of the world economy by looking at trade relations between countries. Right now, the threat of sanctions between America and Europe looms, yet Europe is having quite fruitful trade and business-related discussions with China. For this story, we'll go back to Richard Palmer.
Yes, on April 9th, so that's Tuesday, there was a really significant meeting between Europe and China. They've been doing quite a lot of meetings recently, but I think this one is especially important. Like you said, you can look at the world and you can see almost three trade blocks that if they're not yet at war with each other, trade war with each other, they're certainly competing very hard against each other. The United States, the European Union, and China. And each one of these is, you know, China has been doing things to the United States that are basically trade war. They've also been doing things to the European Union that kind of violate trade norms and you could call a trade war as well. And so, well, you've got these three powers. What's the configuration going to look like? Mm-hmm. And that is kind of what all fell into place on Tuesday. Europe has been pretty annoyed. They've been drawing close to China and we've been tracking that. But at the same time, they have been pretty annoyed at some of the things China has been doing. They've been pretty annoyed with the way that China will, for example, force European companies the same way they will American companies to hand over technology if they want to do business in China, or that they'll force them to work with Chinese subsidiaries that then take all of the European companies', you know, privileged information. And so in the run-up to this meeting, Europe got pretty tough on China. They said, you know, we'll fight. Last month, they identified China as a strategic competitor to the European Union, the first time they'd ever done this. They were threatening to walk away from this annual meeting. And, well, the Wall Street Journal headline on this meeting is EU strong arms China into trade promises. And it seems like they've actually, you know, China will often make noises that they're going to fix this or unsubstantial promises that they'll fix this. It actually looks like Europe has got some real concessions on this. The Wall Street Journal, they wrote, this time, however, the European officials strong-armed their Chinese counterparts. They threatened, well, they talked about some of those last-minute things that I talked about, and they held some different investment opportunities to China for ransom, and China caved in. So what you've got is, with these three different powers, it could have gone any way. Europe could have, say, sided with the United States against China. Or China could have decided to lay down the hatchet with the U.S. and have the U.S. and China go side by side against Europe. That's not what happened. And now you've got these two both under pressure from the United States, both kind of deciding, OK, well, we'll stop fighting each other. We'll stop doing the things that irritate each other. And we'll both instead be in a better position to focus on this problem with the United States. And so at the same time you had this trade meeting this week, you have the United States threatening to put sanctions on Europe because of the way Europe subsidizes Airbus, Europe refusing to back down, and you see this the whole kind of global trade system shifting to be the US and China the EU and China together against the United States.
And that's exactly what we would expect based on what Bible prophecy tells us.
That's right. We have an article on our website right now that goes into this in more detail, but that titled Prophesied 2,500 Years Ago, EU China Uniting Against America. And there's a prophecy in Isaiah 23 that talks about a mart of nations. And as that article will do, you can go through and see who those nations are referring to. But it's basically talking about China. It's talking about Japan. It's talking about these European powers. And they're forming a trade relationship. That whole chapter there is talking all about trade and merchants. And then you look at these other scriptures, it talks about the United States being cut off from world trade. And so for the last nearly 10 years or so, we've been saying, well, watch for China and Europe to come together. Now, the Bible also says that these two fall out. It's not like they're best friends forever. And so this kind of tense but still cooperative relationship that you see building now between the US and China is exactly the picture that you get from Bible prophecy. And this trade relationship where at least the two of them work together for now against the United States, well, that's exactly what Isaiah chapter 23 talks about.
All right. Well, thank you very much for that, Richard. This is Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3, continuing with the story about China. China has continued to push its power at the margins of the Philippines. It's making the Filipino president very uneasy. For this story, we'll go back to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yes, we spoke on the show in early March about how Chinese fishing fleets had asserted control over a string of sandbars near the Philippines' Pagasa Island, which is also called Thitu Island. It's there in the Spratly Islands in the South China Sea. And in the time since then, this illegal Chinese activity has intensified quite a lot, and it's begun to center more on Pagasa Island itself instead of just the sandbars around it. And Pagasa is the largest of 9 features there in the Spratlys that are claimed by the Philippines, and it's the home of hundreds of Filipinos. About 300 civilians and 40 soldiers live there. And a spokesman for the Philippine Navy's Western Command, Captain Jason Ramon, said that since January, 275 Chinese vessels have been sighted around Pagasa Island and around Subi Reef, which is nearby. So he said that these vessels are part of China's Fisherman Navy, as it's come to be called. That's kind of an unofficial extension of the actual Chinese Navy. And China uses fishermen in this way to kind of push against other nations in the South China Sea because it's underhanded. You know, it gives them plausible deniability. China can use this method to prevent the United States from really getting involved because they can always say, well, these are just rogue fishermen that are maybe getting a little too aggressive. But in reality, these fleets answer directly to the Chinese Navy, and they should be viewed as an extension of it and even as a military force. Many of them are also heavily armed. So it's beyond fishermen, despite what China may say there. And Captain Ramon said that the Philippines has challenged many of these Chinese vessels, but that China generally just ignores these challenges and just goes on asserting more and more control over these places that are supposed to belong to the Philippines.
It does seem to reveal something about China that in, say, the Duterte presidency, you have an individual who seems like he would be amenable to having closer relations with China, but China is basically treating the Philippines like it's going to do what it wants to do regardless, and it seems to be almost it's just determined to have its way regardless of what the Philippines does.
It seems sort of counterproductive for China to treat the Philippines this way when the Philippines, under Duterte especially, has shown itself to be, you know, willing to distance itself from the U.S. and its historic alliance with America there that has really defined the South China Sea dynamic for so many decades. And suddenly China's saying, despite these overtures that you've made to us, we're still going to keep pushing in these really aggressive and antagonistic ways. So, yeah, I'm not sure what would motivate China to do this.
It does underline what Gerald Fleury has said about just the way that China's conducting its business throughout that region.
Well, that's true. Yes. Yeah. I think it's more about China pushing at the United States. And if they have to push at the Philippines, a staunch U.S. ally, in order to do that, then that's what they'll do. Even if that ally has shown itself to be kind of dithering in some ways. And that's exactly what Mr. Fleury has written about this dynamic. He wrote an article in our July 2016 issue all about the South China Sea and what's been happening there. It's called China is Steering the World Toward War. In one part of it, he writes, quote, "Since before the Korean War, China has had a strategy to establish a security buffer extending from far beyond its coast and engulfing the entire South China Sea. Its current military buildup in the Paracels and the Spratlys, which includes Pagasa, is bringing China closer to realizing this strategy." And then he points out that all of this is happening in a region that the U.S. has had naval dominance over for some 70 years now. And he says that Beijing is now challenging American naval dominance in that area, and that this should alarm the world. And then he also writes specifically about China's intimidation of nations like the Philippines. He says, quote, "China is intimidating the nations of Southeast Asia into submission to its will. It is forcing these countries to do what it wants. Everything is headed in the direction of war." And I think what we've seen this week with the Pagasa Islands buildup there, the swarming of these fishing fleets, that really is a perfect demonstration of exactly this kind of intimidation that Mr. Fleury wrote about there. But from there, in his article, Mr. Fleury says that these provocations from China are contributing to the fulfillment of a Bible prophecy about modern-day America and Britain losing control of the oceanic gates and all those vital shipping routes that they long controlled. That prophecy is in Deuteronomy 28:52. And Mr. Fleury says that China's takeover of the South China Sea is one of many areas today where onlookers can, quote, already see this prophecy moving toward its fulfillment.
Mm-hmm. A very important article from Gerald Flory, China is steering the world toward war. You can also check out an article that we have there on the front page, China's Fisherman Navy Surrounds Philippines Pagasa Island. We'll put links to both of those articles in the show notes for today's program. Thank you, Jeremiah. One final story, as marijuana is increasingly legalized in America, marijuana use is increasingly common. For this, we'll turn to Andrew Miller.
Yeah, over the last several years, marijuana has become legal in more and more states. It's now legal in 10 states for really any reason at all, and in a full 33 states if you can come up with some sort of a medical reason. But that's about 200 million Americans, about two-thirds of the American population now, that lives in a state where this is legal in one form or another. And that's definitely had an effect in increasing its usage. I know there have been polls that have indicated that up to like 15% of Americans are using marijuana. But they had a sobering study come out this week. It's from Quest Diagnostics. There's probably a lot of our listeners have been examined by them. I know I have as well, because if you're going for like a job interview, a lot of especially jobs that require some technical expertise, they want to make sure you're not on drugs. So you do a basic urine test before you can be hired. And now they published that they'd done over 9 million urine tests, where they're finding that close to 3% of U.S. workers did not pass that test. So that's a 16% increase since just 5 years ago in 2014. And they're saying it's at a 14-year high, but that's sobering because it's not just that's like almost 3%, 2.8% of American workers who are unemployable in some ways due to their marijuana. I mean, not every job requires it, but like a lot of the better-paying jobs that you can't actually even get a job. They're so addicted to this drug. And so this is really significant because it's very well validated through scientific study after scientific study that marijuana has a very negative effect on willpower. There are some studies that even link it to like aggressive behavior. Those are maybe a little more controversial, but it's definitely any medical scientist would agree that it's sapping willpower. That's what you kind of gives like the idea that potheads are lazy. So there's no ambition, no willpower. It's a depressing, depressant drug, depressing and depressant. But and so that actually has even some prophetic implications. I mean, we've in other contexts, as we've talked on this program before, about Isaiah 3, about God taking away from Israel the man of war and the eloquent orator and the cunning artificer and all these leadership positions. Well, here's 3% of Americans who can't even be cunning artificers because they can't pass the urine test required for you to feel safe doing some of those jobs because your judgment's impaired. And even beyond that, even more than those who can't be hired for impaired judgment, just like the lack of ambition that you're not, if you're high on this drug and it's sapping your ambition and it's sapping your willpower and it's making you lazy, you're not doing the study and the training that would be required for those type of jobs that would have 3% is it may sound like a small number, but that is a huge a huge portion of the American population that's really lacks leadership ability or even the potential leader for leadership ability because of their addiction to this drug.
All right. Thank you very much, Andrew. That'll do it for today's Trumpet Hour. Visit the Trumpet Hour Hub on thetrumpet.com for links to the articles and the literature that we discussed on the program today. You can email us your thoughts on the program to letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to our panel, Jeremiah Jacques, Andrew Miller, Richard Palmer, and Brent Noctegal.
It's an honor be here.
Thanks for having me. Great to be here.
Thanks to Jesse Hester for engineering and production. I'll leave you with the words of Dennis Prager. Self-control is infinitely more important than self-esteem. Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
Listening to Trumpet Hour on The Voice, 101.3 KPCG, and on the web at kpcg.fm.